Welcome to Navigating Consciousness. I'm Rupert Sheldrake, and this is a podcast of my talks and conversations. If you enjoy listening, please subscribe and leave a review in your favorite podcatcher. It really helps. Well, thank you, Simon, and thank you, Luke, for your generous introductions. When Luke asked me to come and give this talk, I was quite fascinated by the idea of a society for expeditions and field work. I'd never heard of such a society before, and I've never been asked to give a talk like this before. So I thought this would be an interesting adventure in itself to talk in a way I haven't ever talked before. I've talked about ideas, I've talked about particular scientific ideas, I've talked about a whole range of things, but not really focusing on expeditions and field work. And I'm going to be talking about scientific explorations which involve field work in a variety of different areas. I'm also going to talk about purely scientific explorations, but I won't be dealing in much detail with those because I want to concentrate more on the field work side. When I was thinking about this particular society and its interests, I realized that there's probably some deep atavistic appeal of the idea of expeditions and field work. All our ancestors were hunter-gatherers. Go back, it depends where you're from. I mean, I'm English and my ancestors were probably hunter-gatherers about 3,000 years ago. It depends what part of the world you're from. Some places longer, some places shorter, but go back far enough and they were hunter-gatherers. And hunter-gatherers presumably spent most of their life in expeditions and field work. In order to hunt and gather, you have to go out and explore and know your environment. And you have to be practical and do what you're doing in the field. So they had to acquire an extensive knowledge of botanical natural history for gathering grains, fruits, nuts, etc., and herbal remedies. And also animal behavior for hunting. So I think it's probably deep in all our nature. And I think that's one reason why so many children's stories are about adventures and explorations. And certainly when I was a child, I was very into adventure type stories. When I was very young, my favorite character was Rupert Bear, for obvious reasons. Rupert Bear is a cartoon bear who's a talking animal, like many children's books have talking animals in them. And every episode is a different adventure. He goes off and has an adventure, and he always ends up back home having tea, and there's mummy and daddy, and so on. Then there are a whole lot of other adventure books for children of graded ages. And by the time I was at secondary school, I was reading the sort of more sort of old-style boys' own paper type adventure stories. And because I'm terribly old, I was at school in the 1950s when all attitudes were totally unreconstructed. Wokeness was not even a gleam in anyone's eye. And in the school, I was at a boarding school where one of the main aims of the school traditionally had been to toughen people up so they could go and run the empire. So some of my friends at school did end up as district commissioners in Africa, and by the age of 26 were riding around huge tracts of Africa, administering enormous parts of Africa. So the idea of adventure was actually built into our education. It was we had to do all sorts of things like play rugby 6 days a week in all weather, go on long distance runs, go to rigorous army training camps in the Scottish Highlands under the most primitive conditions, all of them designed to toughen us up. And there was no nonsense about health and safety in those days. So some of the things we did were really dangerous. They'd certainly not be allowed now. And at home, as many of you will have heard, people used to have a great deal more freedom. I could just go and play with friends from the age of about 6 or 7 and ride off all day on my bicycle in the surrounding countryside from the town where I grew up, Newark in Nottinghamshire. And that was all perfectly acceptable and normal. So I grew up with this idea of adventures and expeditions. And the first opportunity I had for a real life one was after my year at Harvard doing history and philosophy of science. I'd seen some pictures of the ruins of a Mayan city called Palenque in Mexico, and I decided I wanted to go there. And it was, I managed to get there traveling by train and bus and hitchhiking. It was pretty difficult to get there then. It's now a major tourist site, but it certainly wasn't at that time. And there indeed were these ruins, as I'd seen in the pictures, but even more spectacular, ruined pyramids covered with strangling figs and jungle growing over everything, giant butterflies flying through the ruins, and nobody there. It was just absolutely amazing. And that gave me a real taste for kind of tropical adventures. When I was at Cambridge doing botany, I had a lecturer called Professor E.J.H. Corner, who'd spent many years in Malaya, where he was an expert on tropical plants. And one of his messages was, you can't understand biology, and particularly botany, unless you've lived and worked in the tropics, because the species richness is so much greater in tropical flora. The further north or south you go, these species just get more and more attenuated. You know, here in England, if you go to an average woodland, there might be six or seven species of trees in it. Well, in the Malaysian jungles, you know, might be 100 in the same area, or 200 different species. And by the time you get further north, you get even more impoverished floras and faunas. So this filled me with an enthusiasm for traveling in the tropics. And in 1968, I was a research fellow of Clare College, Cambridge. I was elected in 67, and I saw an advertisement for a Royal Society travelling student ship, tropical travelling student ship, so I applied for it and got it, a year at the University of Malaya in the botany department. And this was an astonishing experience. It had a big effect on me in, first of all, exposing me to other cultures, because on the way there, I traveled through India. I just stopped off for a few days to start with, and I ran into almost the only person I knew in India, is an anthropologist friend from Cambridge who'd just gone to Delhi for a few days and was going back to his village in a remote part of the Himalayan foothills, and said to me, do you want to come? So I said, yes. So I changed my ticket and indefinitely delayed it, and then headed off to his village. You had to walk several miles, or no, several hours beyond the roadhead to get to this village. So I got an experience of being with an anthropologist. He was a graduate student doing field work. And I was lucky that he'd been there a year or two, so he knew the language and knew lots of people in the village. And so I had a most astonishing time immersed in that world. He told them I was his cousin, so I was sort of accepted as a kind of member of the family. That had a huge impact on me, and I felt a tremendous affinity with India. I then travelled on through Sri Lanka, about a month in Sri Lanka, and then finally arrived 3 or 4 months late in Malaysia. And when I was there, I was working on tropical rainforest ferns, but together with a group of mainly expatriate members of staff at the university, they're mainly Australian. We decided to go on expeditions at weekends. And so they'd been there for a while and knew where to go. And in those days, the lowland rainforest came within about 10 miles of Kuala Lumpur. It was astonishing. I mean, now, of course, it's all been cut back. There's oil palm and rubber plantations and so on. But in those days, you could actually be in the forest, you know, in sort of half an hour. And so we partly went on expeditions in the lowland rainforest. Once or twice we went to desert islands. I recently took part in a kind of local version of Desert Island Discs and said, imagine you're a castaway on a desert island. Well, I actually was, because we paid a fisherman to take us to an uninhabited desert island off the coast of Malaya, and then on Friday, and pick us up on Sunday evening, or longer in some, if we had a longer period. And so we were able to actually go to remote places, explore them, And of course, the desert island was not quite like the ones on desert island discs, because one of the things you soon realize that there are mosquitoes, and in the jungle there are leeches, and there are all sorts of hazards. So some of these were just fun expeditions, adventures. But I also went on some more serious ones. One of my colleagues there was called John Drensfield, who was doing a PhD from Cambridge on palm taxonomy. And he was working with the Forest Research Institute of Malaya. And there was a group of people leading expeditions. And I went along on some of these expeditions. We'd go deep into the forest. And we went with some Aboriginal tree climbers, because the trees are very high. You can't collect leaves and flowers and things at ground level. So somebody has to climb an enormous tree, and none of the Forest Research Institute people could do it, but the local Aborigines were fantastic at doing this. So we went with these tree climbers, and every expedition we went on, they found species new to science. And Drensfield once told me he'd found something that he must show me, and he took me on, just the two of us, into the forest. He discovered a completely new species of palm tree, which he named Johannes Tasmania Magnifica, because it was completely magnificent, with 3 meter long leaves, 2 meters across. And when we saw it, it was in the middle of a clearing in the forest. And there was this absolutely beautiful palm, new to science. Of course, it wasn't new to the local people there, because they knew the plants very well, but scientists are sort of very late in catching up on a lot of these species. So it was quite exciting to be part of these old school, old style adventures and expeditions. Now, I've also been engaged in explorations in a variety of different areas, and I'm going to talk about, first of all, about the scientific and philosophy area, because this isn't so much about field work, so I'll just talk about this fairly briefly, although it's what I'm probably best known for. When I was doing research at Cambridge for my PhD and then later as a Royal Society Research Fellow, I was looking at plants and how they grow, plant development. And I was looking for how a particular plant hormone called auxin is made. And I discovered it's actually made by dying cells. As cells die, they break down. As the proteins break down, they release amino acids, including tryptophan. As that breaks down, it gives rise to a whole range of things, including indole acetic acid, this hormone, and tryptamine, and a variety of other compounds. So I discovered it was made by dying cells, and that was very exciting because everyone expected it to be made by some complex synthetic pathway. And I discovered it was made by dying animal cells, dying yeast cells, any dying cell. We produce auxin more per unit weight than most plants. It comes out in your urine. It's not a hormone for us, but it is for plants. So I worked on that, and I worked on the way it's transported around the plant. And I also worked on cellular senescence and rejuvenation. These were exciting areas of inquiry, but they were lab-based, so all the research basically was in the lab, which I enjoyed doing. I very much enjoyed laboratory experiments. You can ask a question, you can do the experiment, and you get an answer. Sometimes it's a muddled answer, sometimes it's confusing, sometimes it's not what you expect. But it's basically treating nature as a kind of oracle. The experimental method, you ask the question, you get some sort of answer. I really enjoyed that. It was a thrilling thing to do. But after a while of doing this at Cambridge, I began to feel that it wasn't that exciting working in a lab all the time. And I really felt a strong attraction to India again. I traveled there in 1968. And then, this was now 1974, a job came up at a new international agricultural research institute called ICRISAT, the International Crops Research Institute for the Semi-Arid Tropics. And they needed a plant physiologist, and I had the right qualifications. So I applied for the job, and I got it. So I became the principal plant physiologist at this new institute that was just starting. The reason for the Institute was that the Green Revolution, which I'm sure all of you have heard of, was mainly to do with producing new varieties of wheat and rice, which grow under irrigated conditions. The Green Revolution doesn't work without irrigation and fertilizers. But that left an awful lot of farmers, at least 70% of the farmers in India who don't have irrigation, unable to take part in it. They were growing crops like chickpea and pigeon pea, which are the ones I was working on, which had had practically no scientific research ever done on them. And so I was the principal plant physiologist for chickpeas and pigeon peas. This was very exciting because you could read the entire previous literature in about an afternoon. There was so little that had been done. And this, for me, is what I like most, working in previously unexplored areas of science, and areas where it's not intensely competitive, where everyone's just working on details of the same problem, but where you've got a blank slate. So we basically got to know the plants. We did what's called a growth analysis, growing them different varieties under different conditions, and just studying week by week how they grew. It's a descriptive study, and then studying their natural history. And then we did experiments in the field on their physiology. Most people who do research on plant physiology here in Britain do it in plants in plant pots in greenhouses. And it's very difficult to do in fields here because you need a lot of labor. Well, I had a lot of labor. I had about 100 laborers working for me, mostly illiterate. And my Indian colleagues were used to working with illiterate people. And what it meant was that we could do experiments that would be inconceivable here. The experiments were literally field work. I mean, they were in fields. And agricultural research has pioneered the use of statistics. R.A. Fisher, who was one of the principal architects of modern statistics, was an agricultural statistician at the Rothamsted Experimental Research Station, agricultural research station. And agricultural research is all about doing replicated trials in the field. The fields vary. Sometimes the soil has a patch that's not very good. You may get a bit that's damaged by insects and so on. So a lot of variation in the field, but you do things in replicated trials and use these kinds of statistics. So you can actually do reliable research under unreliable conditions. And I was doing all my experiments under these conditions. So for example, if you want to know what happens if the pigeon peas are attacked by insects that eat the flowers and destroy the flowers, then can they recover from that? So you can do an experiment. We did such an experiment. You have remove all the flowers for 1 week in one plot, replicated plots, for 2 weeks, for 3 weeks, for 4 weeks, for 5 weeks. So you can actually have people going around all the, in a plot of the field, removing flowers from every single plant. I mean, you couldn't possibly do that here because, you know, the labor costs would be impossibly high, but there the labor costs were very low. Equipment costs were very high. My colleague who was working on cereal physiology went down the equipment route. He spent all his time trying to get fancy equipment imported through the docks in Bombay. He had to have lots of paperwork. When he got the equipment and installed it, it usually lasted about an hour because we had such wildly fluctuating electric currents. You'd suddenly have a surge and all the bulbs would burst, and then at other times the current would go down, a 100-watt bulb would just have a dim red glow. And we had about 50% power cuts when I was there. The power just didn't work at all about half the time. So working with laborers in the field turned out to be a much better way of doing it. It also provided opportunities for traveling around India, because I ran experiments on how pigeon peas are influenced by day length and temperature. And instead of controlled environment conditions, which are very expensive and we didn't have, I had them planted at 4 latitudes in India, at government field stations, at 2 altitudes in each latitude. So we were able to do a lot of this research using field work as the method. And I came to see what a wonderful thing it is to be able to work in the field. because the results you get are directly applicable to the field. Whereas if you had molecular studies in labs on plant in plant science labs, there's such a huge gulf from that to anything that's practical that on the whole most of these discoveries have no effect at all. I also had to run experiments on chickpeas in the summer months when they don't grow in the plains of India, and we had to find places we could grow them. I was very pleased to find that one of the few places this would work was in a very remote part of India on the border of Tibet called Lahul. Lahul Spiti district is in Himachal Pradesh. It was when I was there, it was no foreigners were allowed because it's on the Tibetan border, it's a sensitive area, but I had a special permit. So I was able to go there, and I lived in this Tibetan-style house. They all spoke Tibetan. There was nowhere else to live in the village except with this family. And it was a polyandrous society. The land was inherited through the women. And so the woman inherited it and then would marry a whole batch of brothers. So the house I was in, she had six husbands, all brothers. That system was designed to keep the land together in these women-centered inheritance systems. And that was very fascinating, living there and working in that village. The headman, the Thakur of Gondla, lived in a tower, a crumbling tower, and used to invite me in the evenings to sit with him. And he had a kind of hookah pipe. I had to speak Hindi. There was a boy sitting on the floor who'd sort of pass the thing from backwards and forwards between us. So we'd spend our evenings and drinking local beer. So I had a really nice time doing field work, agricultural field work in Malaya. And one of the things that it encouraged me to do was to take up field work under much more mundane, everyday conditions when I got back to Britain. Before that, I'll just say a little bit about adventures of ideas. When I was at Cambridge, I was working on how plant form is inherited. And I came to the conclusion that certainly molecules are involved, genes are involved, but we'd never explain it through genes. We had to have a top-down causation through something called morphogenetic fields, form-shaping fields. And to explain how those could be inherited seemed almost impossible, unless there was a kind of memory transmitted directly across time. And so I came up with the idea of morphic resonance, which in its most general sense says the laws of nature are more like habits. And when I came up with this idea at Cambridge, it didn't go over very well with my colleagues in the biochemistry department. It went a bit better on high table at Clare College, where as a fellow, historians and philosophers were very helpful and interested. But I realized this was too radical an idea to publish without really thinking about it a lot more. So I did. While I was in India, while I was doing agricultural research, I spent 4 or 5 years thinking about it in my spare time and reading about it until I reached the point where I could write about it. And I then took 2 years off. I lived in a small Christian ashram in South India, in Tamil Nadu, to write this book, but also to take part in a community that was based really on meditation, yoga, spiritual practices. And that for me was a whole other kind of field work, consciousness, and the study of consciousness itself through meditation, through chanting, fasting, and a whole variety of other spiritual practices. So I got a kind of personal adventure through living in this ashram at the same time as having the time and space to write my first book, which was called A New Science of Life, came out in 1981. This had a kind of radicalizing effect on me because I realized that so many of the assumptions we have in science are simply assumptions. They've hardened into dogmas. The idea that nature is governed by fixed laws, for example, it was an assumption in 17th century science based on the idea that the laws of nature are given by God and God's eternal, so they should be eternal. Lots of scientists don't believe in God anymore, But they've still got fixed laws which are invisible, present everywhere at all times and in all places. And when the Big Bang Theory came along, saying everything in the universe is evolutionary, the fixed law idea just carried on as a kind of habit of thinking. So I think actually the laws of nature evolve along with nature, and as I said, I think they're more like habits. Then I realized that a great deal more of science is based on assumptions that have hardened into dogmas. And when you turn them into questions, then exciting new areas of exploration come up, scientific areas of exploration where you can do new experiments. My book, The Science Delusion, which was published in 2012, is the new edition here is 2020, is based on the 10 central dogmas of science. Matter is unconscious. The laws of nature are fixed. The total amount of matter and energy is always the same. The mind's nothing but the activity of the brain and confined to the inside of the head. Nature is purposeless, and so on. When you turn them into questions, is matter unconscious? Is the mind confined to the brain? And so on. Then a whole lot of new questions open up, which I think are more scientific than science being a series of fixed dogmas. Now, this, of course, gets me into trouble. I think that at any stage in the history of science, there's always a tendency for fixed ideas to become too fixed, too rigid. And I think we're definitely in that state at the moment. And I think we're on the cusp of a major paradigm shift towards a more holistic view of science. Anyway, that's the theme of The Science Delusion. My book on morphic resonance, The Presence of the Past, summarizes the hypothesis in detail. But that's not my main topic this evening, which is fieldwork. So what I'm going to do now is move on to another area of inquiry, fieldwork, which is what I've been doing here in Britain, on what I call the mysteries of everyday life. I think a great many phenomena that we all experience are profoundly mysterious, and the research on them can actually be done almost free of charge in the real world. And this has been one of the areas I've been concentrating on over the last 20 or 30 years. I have time here to mention only three of these areas. Firstly, it turns out that animals, pets like dogs and cats, do all sorts of things which don't seem to be explicable in terms of normal standard science. In particular, they're often telepathic with their owners. They pick up their owner's thoughts or intentions. Now, of course, if the owner's in the same room, then you'll all think, oh, well, it must just be subtle cues, or, you know, unconscious behavioral things and so on, which it could be. So I concentrated on the phenomenon that was easiest to test, namely dogs that know when their owners are coming home. A lot of people have dogs. About 50% of dog owners have dogs that go and wait by the door or window when the person's on the way home. And they often do it for 10 minutes or more, sometimes half an hour or more. Now, you'd immediately think, well, isn't it just routine? Isn't it just hearing a familiar car engine and so on? So you can test that. Does it happen when people come at non-routine times in unfamiliar vehicles? The answer is yes. And we did filmed experiments. We filmed dogs in people's houses. Film the place where the dog waits the whole time the person's out, have them come back at randomly chosen times in unfamiliar vehicles. And over again, the dogs went and waited when they were coming. We had control periods when they weren't coming home at all during the experimental period, and the dog didn't wait. So there's a film of one of these on my website, one of these experiments you can see, and this is all published in peer-reviewed journals. But it turned out to be fascinating to work with dogs and cats. And as soon as I started appealing for information, it came in torrents. I now have a database with about 12,000 stories on it of people's stories about their own unexplained experiences and those of dogs and cats. There is an example of field work that can be done virtually free of charge using animals that we really know well. I give many more examples in my book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. I also got interested in homing pigeons and how they home. No one knows how they do it. And all sorts of theories have been tried. You know, is it the sun's position? Is it remembering the local landmarks and so forth? Nowadays, if you ask people, they say, oh, it's all been explained by magnetism, because it was really scraping the bottom of the barrel. They do have a magnetic sense, but it can't explain homing, because if you're going to find your way home from an unknown place, you need more than a compass. If you were dropped, parachuted into an unknown place and given a very good compass, you'd know where north was, but you wouldn't know where home was. I think pigeons have a sense of direction that links them to their home, a kind of directional field that they pick up, a field at present unknown to science. Anyway, this is an area I've done a lot of research on, and that's necessarily field research. Some of it I did with a ship from the Royal Dutch Navy, where we had homing pigeons with a mobile loft that went from one side of the Atlantic to the other. And we trained the pigeons to home to a moving ship. And that could dealt with a lot of the arguments about, well, it must be geographical coordinates. With a moving ship at sea, then it's moving all the time. It's a moving target, and they could still find it. So anyway, I don't have time, I'm afraid, to do more than mention some of these areas of field research. You can't do research on homing pigeons in the laboratory. You've got to do it in the field. Then coming to unexplained human abilities, one of the ones that I've worked on is the feeling of being stared at. Nobody knows how our minds work or where they are. And the normal assumption is that it's all inside the brain. It's inside your head. Neural activity causes mental activity. It's a kind of epiphenomenon or another aspect of what's happening in the brain. And when it comes to something like vision, that theory says that vision works by light coming into the eyes, inverted images on the retinas, changes in the brain and optic areas of the brain. And then you're supposed to produce an image inside the head, a three-dimensional full-color representation, kind of a virtual reality display. So right now, when you see me standing here, this meant, according to this official theory, the whole of this room and me are all inside your head, not outside where they seem to be. Now, it's very hard for most people really to believe that, but that's the official view, and you won't get a job in neuroscience unless you subscribe to that kind of view. It's just the official view. It doesn't correspond at all with our own experience. And the older view of vision, which the ancient Greeks had and which virtually everybody in the world has, unless they've had a Western scientific education, is that vision involves a two-way process. Light comes in and images are projected out. So my image of each of you is where you are. It's projected out by my eyes, through my eyes, in the opposite direction to the light coming in. When you look at something in a mirror, what you're seeing is your own visual projections that go straight through the mirror. They're called virtual images in physics textbooks because they're in the mind, but they're not really where they seem to be. You've projected them there. So if our minds actually project out everything we're seeing, it affects the way we experience our everyday life right now. I mean, I actually believe that my mind stretches out and is all around me, and everything I'm seeing is in my mind, but it's not in my brain. If my mind reaches out to touch what I'm looking at, then I might be able to affect things by looking at them. In particular, if I look at somebody from behind, they might be able to feel me looking at them, and they might turn around and look back. Now, as soon as you say that, you realize the sense of being stared at, or scopesthesia as it's known scientifically, scop as in microscope, look, aesthesia, feeling as in anesthesia. This is a very common phenomenon. 95% of people have experienced it, and I'm guessing most people here will have done. So what does science have to say about it? The answer is, until the 1980s, practically nothing whatever, a completely taboo topic, not even investigated by psychic researchers and parapsychologists, even though everybody knows about it, including children. It's a remarkable thing. So I started doing research on the sense of being stared at, simple randomized trials, looking or not looking in a randomized order, people blindfolded, sometimes through one-way, two-way mirrors or through windows to rule out sound or smell cues. And over again, the results come out significant. A meta-analysis of the best papers was published by a colleague of mine, shows that the odds against chance are literally astronomical, as 10 to the minus 17. These are hugely significant results. It's not surprising to most people that it's significant, because most people have experienced it. I am today launching a new app, works on mobile phones, so anyone can do these experiments for themselves. It gives you randomized instructions, and the person who's looked at has a phone where they say whether they're being looked at or not. And that, because it's now for the first time available on an app, you can do it through windows or at any arbitrary distance very easily. And the aim of the app is to encourage people to practice this. Most people aren't that good at it. They get self-conscious. They score a bit above chance, but not very much above chance. And so the aim of the app is so people can practice this and become better at it. And that would provide us with much greater opportunities to investigate the phenomenon. And that, again, is field work that anyone can take part in free of charge, to do with something everyone's experienced that has huge implications for our understanding of the nature of our minds, that corresponds with our everyday experience every time we look at something, and which is virtually uncharted territory scientifically. It's unbelievable that there are huge areas which are almost completely unexplored, even today in the 21st century. They're unexplored because the taboo has been so strong that no one's explored them because they're afraid they'll lose their job, they won't get grants, they won't be promoted, they'll be attacked by skeptics. There are organized groups of skeptics. Perhaps the most vigorous one is a group called Guerrilla Skeptics on Wikipedia that edit all pages on Wikipedia to do with people like me or to do with phenomena like telepathy or the sense of being stared at, to portray them in the most negative possible light. And the reason they do this is because they're convinced of the materialist theory of nature, which says the mind is nothing but the brain. Since they really believe that, I mean, they're quite sincere, they really believe it. From that point of view, it's things like the sense of being stared at is deemed impossible. It can't happen, therefore it doesn't happen. Therefore, all the evidence for it is flawed or fraudulent. And all the people who put this evidence forward, like me, are charlatans, because it's totally impossible. That's the state of play when you get to the debate with the skeptic groups. In fact, some of them have recently written papers saying that there's no point actually looking at the evidence because it's a waste of time. So here's an area where there's a fantastic potential for research. Untapped, almost untapped. I just finished a paper yesterday on 250 case studies of where people can wake other people or animals by staring at them, staring people awake. It's never been described. It's a new phenomenon to science. It's new, not new in the real life. Lots of people are aware of it. But it's completely new to science. I published a lot of research in a journal called the Journal of Scientific Exploration, which is peer-reviewed journal, which deals with exploring areas that most of science doesn't look at. Finally, I'll just mention research on telephone telepathy. 85% of people have had the experience of thinking of someone who then calls. If that's funny, I was just thinking about you. Or they just know who it is before they look at caller ID or answer the phone. It's very, very common. The standard skeptical response to this for more than 100 years since the telephone was invented, it's been going on for a long time, is, oh, well, people think about others all the time, and then someone rings and they imagine it's telepathy and they just forget all the other times they're wrong. Or else, when they know people really well, they can unconsciously anticipate when they're going to ring. Those are completely standard armchair arguments, and probably you've heard them yourself. You may even have said them yourself if people mention this phenomenon. However, they've not been tested scientifically. It's not enough to put forward a scientific hypothesis like this skeptical hypothesis. It needs to be tested. And you can test this. is it really chance coincidence or isn't it? In the basic experiments that I've been doing, we have four callers. We have volunteers who say it happens to them sometimes. We have four callers. We pick the caller at random and ring them up and say, can you ring your friend now? Think about them for a minute or two and ring them. We have the subjects at home in a room where they're being filmed with no on a landline, with no mobile phone or computer in the room. When the phone rings, they have to say to the camera who they think is ringing. I think it's John, and they pick the phone up. Hello, John. They're right or wrong. They'd be right 25% of the time by pure random guessing. In hundreds of trials, the average of these film trials, the average hit rate was 45%, was significant, 10 to the minus 9. It was, I mean, hugely significant effects. This has now been repeated in the University of Amsterdam and the University of Freiburg in Germany. A recent meta-analysis of 15 studies on telephone, email, and text message telepathy shows massively significant results. And I also have an app. It's not working at the moment, but I had developed an app where you could do this on your mobile phone, which also gave positive results. So this kind of field work, dealing with phenomena that lead to a completely new interpretation of the way that our minds work, which fits with our experience, which means that we need to expand our scientific model of reality. I'm not anti-science, I'm totally pro-science. But I think that by sticking to these dogmas, saying we can't explore these areas, they're forbidden areas, you can't do it as a graduate student because you won't get a job afterwards if you do anything too controversial. You can't do it as you're more grown up because you won't get a grant or you'll lose your credibility, etc., etc. These are protected by powerful taboos, and yet these areas of inquiry, I think, are ones which could completely transform our understanding of nature, which I think is at present very limited. And I think we're on the threshold of a massive expansion in the scope and possibilities for science. And I think they're going to come from field work, from doing research in the real world, starting from the natural history of these phenomena, which is still, like my paper on waking animals and people by staring at them, it's doing basic natural history. It turns out it works best. It doesn't work so well when the animals are dreaming. It's directional. When they wake up, they look straight towards the person who's looking at them in most cases. So the natural history tells us quite a lot. And then we can do experimental tests to see if this works. And the one with dogs, anyone can do. The slogan for that is, don't let sleeping dogs lie. Stare at them and see if you can wake them up. And I now have several people doing this with filming the dog and with very impressive results so far. Well, there is, I'm afraid I've given a rather rushed overview of various examples of field work and a little bit in terms of expeditions. And expeditions can be intellectual as well as physical. And looking into the foundations of science is just one such expedition. And what I suppose what I really want to say is that it's possible to do truly exploratory work and field work without going very far, without you can do it at home as part of ordinary life. And it's surprising how few people are doing it. And it's also very cheap, so there's no barrier to doing it other than motivation. So I'm particularly pleased that there is a fieldwork society that can emphasize this really important part of science. Thank you.
Put your hands up if you'd like to ask a few questions. Shall we do the bus at the back first?
Yes. Hi. I was wondering if you felt a difference in the way you perceive nature from before you had that sort of concept of everything working in harmony, nature working in harmony, compared to post-Kuhn theory. And is there any, do you have an example of maybe the first time that change of feeling occurred to you?
I think one of the things that made a really, really big difference, I didn't mention this evening, a whole other area of exploration is psychedelics. I first took LSD around 1971. And for me, that was a kind of transformative experience, like a rite of passage, because nothing in the study of the brain or the nervous system that I'd done as part of my physiology course at Cambridge prepared me for anything like that, nor the rather arid, logical, positivist type philosophy that was dominant at the time. And so I realized that consciousness itself is vastly greater than anything I'd been told about. And that made me interested in meditation, and I did at first transcendental meditation. Then when I was living in Hyderabad, India, working at Ikrasat, I had a Sufi teacher. And then later, when I was living in a Christian ashram, I took up Christian meditation, which I still do. For me, that was, I think, that experience. But also being in India, when I traveled through India in 1968, and finding a culture where people had such a completely different view of the world, which made sense. I mean, they thought nature was alive. They thought Mother Earth was alive. Well, then the Gaia hypothesis came along within science, but there was a kind of lived experience for people. And the whole place was full of sacred cows and sacred plants and animals. And the idea that the mind is much greater than the brain, and indeed that mental abilities pervade the whole body and the chakras and so on. And all of this, for me, was, I'd never been taught any of this before. And in the history of science that I'd done, there was absolutely none of this either, because it was all Western science. So for me, it was a combination of India and psychedelics. And I think this whole area of psych, I didn't really touch on it in the talk, there wasn't time, but I think one of the areas of exploration at the moment that's particularly exciting is psychedelic research, because this really is exploring the nature of the mind. And there's now official research going on here in London. Some of it of a completely heroic nature. I mean, I don't know if any of you are familiar with DMT, dimethyltryptamine, but it's very fast-acting and incredibly intense psychedelic. Lasts only a few minutes. And so the people who have this can't give very detailed reports on the experience because it's so short. There are now people in London on official legal research programs having intravenous deep infusions of DMT that last half an hour. I wouldn't volunteer for that, but there are plenty of people who have done. And this is taking this kind of research into completely uncharted territory. So I think that, this combination of India and psychedelics, and then living in Malaya and the sheer richness of the tropics was what shifted my worldview. And before that, I'd been educated in a kind of standard materialist, atheist, science and reason will triumph above all, everything else is superstition. The standard issue when I was being educated was what scientists were meant to think. I believed it. But over the years, I came to realize it was a very limited view.
The gentleman over there.
All right, so first of all, thank you for not using PowerPoint. I found it refreshing to hear somebody speak. I have a question about, I think I mentioned it before the presentation, there's the James Randi Educational Foundation. It's a $1 million prize for anybody who could demonstrate paranormal or telepathic behavior. Have you ever tried to win one of those? Or, because they are in a very controlled environment, it's all recorded on video and should be reproducible, that's the only condition that is required.
Well, if only it were what it seems to be. I've had several encounters with James Randi. and James Randi had no scientific qualifications. He was a magician, a conjurer. And when I published my research on dogs that know when their owners are coming home, James Randi gave an interview to an American magazine called Dog World about my research, saying he'd examined all my videotapes of the experiments and found they didn't show anything like what I claimed. And he'd done a whole series of experiments himself and refuted this stupid claim about psychic dogs. So I wrote to him saying, no, let me see your video analysis of my videos, because I was pretty sure he hadn't seen them, because I hadn't given them out to anyone he knew. And I said, and let's see the results of your own experiment showing negative results. He didn't reply, so I repeatedly wrote to him, didn't reply. So then I wrote to his scientific advisory board saying, could you ask him to reply, which they did. He then replied saying he'd falsely claimed he'd seen my videos, he'd never actually seen them, and the research he'd done with dogs had happened 10 years ago, the results had all been lost in the flood, and it was only 2 weeks and it was an informal test. So I didn't give me a great trust in James Randi, who was himself, he called himself a liar. I discovered that he was totally dishonest. But then, to check this out, a colleague in America found a dog that knew when it was coming home, asked if he could apply for the James Randi Prize to show this dog really did know when he was coming home, didn't get a reply. He replied, asked him again 2 or 3 times, and then Randi wrote back saying, do you think I can waste my time on stupid stories about dogs? So I'm afraid I don't take him very seriously. He's dead now, but I didn't take him seriously.
The prize is still there.
No, it isn't. No, it's the Committee for Scientific Investigation has another prize, about $500,000, they say. And I think that may be a more reliable one, because some of the people there have some scientific credentials. But they're very slippery. You see, it's more a polemical device. And James Randi said that the person had to be able to just demonstrate this ability in a kind of stage show. He was thinking of terms something like a magic trick. Whereas the kind of phenomena I'm studying requires statistical evidence. It's not like, here's the spotlight, here's the thing, here's the one test, there's the result. These telephone telepathy things are statistical results. He didn't know anything about statistics. You know, I asked him, I did have quite a few exchanges, but like some of his colleagues, he wasn't seriously interested, in my opinion, in finding positive results. He was a debunker, and his primary aim was to debunk. Now, I may have got him wrong, but my encounters with him were not encouraging, as I've said. The present team, this $500,000, what I'm doing at the moment is launching apps like the one that's launched today, the Staring app, encouraging people to try and get better at it. It's because most people don't study that much about chance. Some people probably could get good at it. In martial arts, they train people to get better at knowing when they're being stared at from behind. So I'm sure it's trainable. Then when somebody's really good at it, I should encourage them to apply for that prize and call their bluff, and let's see what happens. So I'm actually interested in taking it up, but it would have to be done with someone who's practiced and who's good at it, or with a dog that's very good at it, but he wouldn't consider dogs.
Any other questions?
I think your talk was absolutely fascinating, by the way, so thank you very much. Chris, I have you related to the experience you had in India, and I know you spent time with Beat Professor Shanti Vanan. How did it influence your thinking? So if you hadn't been there, how would you have thought versus now that you've been there in terms of your thinking evolution?
Well, I already had the idea of morphic resonance in Cambridge before I even went to India, so it didn't give me that particular idea. What living in this ashram with this Benedictine monk, Bede Griffiths, who lived as a sannyasin, as a Indian holy man, he wore orange robes, and what for me was so important was that he provided a bridge between East and West. That I was very interested in Eastern philosophy, particularly philosophy of mind, Hindu from the Upanishads and so on. He was extremely knowledgeable about that. But what I didn't know was the whole tradition of philosophy and theology in the West, particularly from the Middle Ages, when it was based on mystical experience. Since the Scientific Revolution, a lot of theology has been trying to adapt to science. If the world's a machine, then God must be a machine maker. I don't find that very interesting. But the mystical theology of the Middle Ages and the Neoplatonic tradition, he knew also very well, and it helped me make bridges between these traditions, particularly the philosophy of form of St. Thomas Aquinas, where he followed Aristotle in saying that the soul is the form of the body. The soul is not in the body is in the soul, and the soul shapes the form. And actually doing many of the things that morphogenetic fields do in biological theory. So for me, it was a way of connecting with Western, a whole chunk of Western thought I was completely unaware of, and integrating it with Eastern thought. And also in my own personal development, and I went through an atheist phase, then there was sort of interest in Eastern thought and Hindu things. And then when I was in India, to my surprise, I was drawn back to a Christian path. I was confirmed in the Church of South India, having refused to get confirmed at my Anglican boarding school. Then I wanted to find a way of integrating Eastern and Western spirituality, and Pete Griffiths provided that in a very, very, very helpful way. Because in his ashram, there was yoga and there was meditation. We had 2 hours every morning and evening. I was sitting on the bank of a sacred river meditating. And a variety of other spiritual practices, like fasting, which I took up there, were very helpful. And one thing I learned from him, and indeed from the whole Indian tradition, was the importance of pilgrimage. And since then, probably one of the things that's made most impact since I've been back in Britain is this rediscovery of pilgrimage that's going on here in Europe. You know, the Santiago de Compostela in Spain, when that pilgrimage was revived in 1987, about 1,000 people walked there. It had dwindled to a trickle before that. In 2019, there were 350,000 people walking there. It's a huge growth, and it's triggered off an enormous interest in pilgrimage all over Europe. And I helped found something called the British Pilgrimage Trust, which has a website, britishpilgrimage.org, which is reopening the ancient footpath pilgrimage routes in Britain, and now has more than 100 routes. Some of them are long ones, like from Winchester to Canterbury. It takes 29 days. Some are just one-day routes you can do in a single day. And some are in London. You can do pilgrimages in London as well. There are many holy places here. So I think what's happened for me is when I came back to England through the lens of India and what I'd learned from Bede Griffiths, suddenly I rediscovered that this is full of holy places, nature here is alive, and I think of as sacred, that we can reactivate pilgrimage and these practices as part of everyday life. And actually, one in relation to this particular society, one form of doing a pilgrimage is a kind of expedition with a particular purpose, connecting with a sacred place. And it's also field work. It's an incredibly good way of connecting with nature. I started doing these one-day ones about 10 years ago. I had a teenage godson, and I thought I should do a bit more as a godfather than just slip him a £20 note on his birthday. And then I hit on this idea of offering a pilgrimage. So I said to him, "Would you like, as your birthday present when he was 14, would you like to go on a pilgrimage? We take a train to a small village near Canterbury. We walk 6 or 7 miles through orchards, meadows, woods. We visit an ancient holy well. We go to the cathedral. We light candles at the shrine. We give thanks or pray for something. We have a cream tea. Go to Choral Evensong and then get the fast train back." And I said, "Would you like to do that?" And without hesitation, he said yes. And so every year, while he was a teenager, we did a different cathedral, Lincoln, Ely, 5 or 6 miles through the countryside. It was just a fantastic way of being together. So Britain's full of underemployed godparents. So I'm suggesting to anyone I know who's a godparent, you know, try it out with your godchildren. And so I think there's all sorts of simple ways of transforming the way we live here at home, and my time in India and these changes in my scientific thinking have actually completely transformed the way I see and experience the world around me, in a way that makes it much more fun and much more alive. So I'm hugely grateful for all the things I learned when I was in Asia, and I don't think I would have learned them without going there.
Yes.
I wanted to ask if there are any differences, like to understand the clash between you and other members of the scientific community, and if you could identify any parts of your scientific method, perhaps some of the fundamental axioms which you held different. And I was thinking about kind of core mental aspects like falsifiability, kind of replicability, empirical rationalism and induction, or do you think it's purely the questions you ask that is what it's to be?
No, I'm quite conservative in terms of scientific methods. You know, I use standard scientific methods, standard statistics. For example, the telephone telepathy tests that I mentioned, you know, using completely standard statistics for that. We have controlled experiments, randomized methods, published in peer-reviewed journals. All of that is, I don't have a problem with that. All the hypotheses I put forward are testable. I think that's a really important part of it, and I spend a lot of my time actually trying to test them. When people say something should be refutable, that's Sir Karl Popper who first put forward that area of scientific theory should be refutable. It was a kind of logical point. In practice, as many philosophers and sociologists of science have shown, it's very hard to refute a scientific theory because people will constantly go on bringing in extra epicycles to try and explain it. For example, there are a lot of people who believe the mind's confined to the inside of the brain, as I mentioned. It's the standard assumption. Do any of them try and refute it? Well, I've never met one who did. If I try and refute it by things like experiments on the sense of being stared at, are they interested in the evidence? Well, for the most part, no. So here we have an example of an actual sociology of science where I'm trying to play by the rules, but I find that most of my opponents don't. I certainly believe in the standard approach to replicability. The telephone telepathy tests have been replicated in, as I mentioned, by other independent investigators. So I certainly believe in replication and all these things that are part of the scientific method. My experiments are actually, as I say, quite conservative, even though the themes of the experiments are not the usual ones.
Matthew, thank you for sharing your time and your thoughts. You spoke a lot about that you're feeling that we're on the cusp of a more holistic understanding of science. But you also spoke about the kind of guerrilla skeptics. And I was wondering what's leading to that feeling in you that we're on that cusp of a more holistic understanding. Is that largely kind of psychedelic research, or is it a broader spectrum of research?
I think that we're on the cusp of for several reasons. First of all, I think most of physics, I think, is stuck. Cosmology is stuck. It's been going on and on for years now about dark matter and dark energy, and no one knows what they are. 95% of reality is utterly unknown to us, according to contemporary physics. Physicists are driven to try and explain the fixed laws of nature. They say, well, if the laws of nature are all fixed at the moment of the Big Bang, which is one of their assumptions I already mentioned, then there's only two possible explanations. Either there's a kind of designer god who tunes the laws, or there must be quadrillions of actual universes and we can only be in the one that we actually know really exists. So a lot of top physicists or cosmologists now believe in a multiverse without a shred of evidence for it. Not a shred. A proliferation of universes, quadrillions of universes, actual universes, to try and explain the fact the laws are fixed in our universe. I don't think it's a fact at all, and I don't think it needs explaining. But there's a lot about modern cosmology, particularly, which is now untestable. Superstring theory, the main thing in physics, is, many would say, untestable. So there's a lot of crisis within physics. There are quite a number of physicists who think there's a crisis brewing. The second reason is that consciousness studies are now part of the scientific agenda. In the 20th century, the dominant school of thought in psychology was that was behaviorism. All you can do is measure behavior, muscular movements or glandular secretions, and subjective consciousness was considered unscientific, and you shouldn't mention it. You shouldn't even mention it. You should only measure things, rats pushing levers and stuff. Well, when I was at Cambridge, that was what psychologists did, and it was consciousness wasn't on their agenda at all. Then cognitive neuroscience took over from behaviorism. That was all computer models. The brain's a computer. It's doing algorithms. Again, nothing about consciousness. But then when consciousness studies started, got going as a branch of science, then people started looking at near-death experiences, you know, altered states of consciousness, psychedelic experiences, lucid dreaming, all these kinds of things, which enormously meditative experiences, mystical states. This, which is now part of consciousness studies with journals and peer-reviewed papers and things, has enormously increased our view of consciousness. And meanwhile, philosophers of mind, materialist philosophers, try to explain that they have what's now, everyone agrees, is the hard problem. The hard problem is that materialism says that the whole universe is made of matter or physical reality, which is unconscious. And that's what science is about, objective study of unconscious matter. But then, of course, the question comes up, well, how come we are conscious? We ought not to be. If the whole universe is made up of unconscious matter and there's nothing but unconscious matter. So some philosophers of mind have made entire careers arguing that we're not conscious. It's just folk psychology, a superstition, and that eventually we'll be able to replace this with neuroscience and give an objective description of what's happening in the brain to explain everything. Others say that consciousness is an illusion. But as their critics point out, to try and dismiss consciousness as an illusion doesn't solve the problem, because illusion is a mode of consciousness. So it doesn't get rid of consciousness. That's why it's called the hard problem. And currently, the main way that people are trying to escape from the hard problem is through panpsychism. Galen Strawson and Philip Goff are two philosophers who have led the way in Britain in this. And what they say is that there's just a tiny little bit of consciousness even in an electron or a proton or an atom. And as you get more and more complex, as systems get more and more complex, you get more and more consciousness till when you reach the level of the brain. Then consciousness as we know it happens, but it's not a difference in kind, it's a difference in degree. So panpsychism, the idea that there's consciousness in nature, is of course a very old view. It used to be called animism. And the fact that this is now very seriously entertained by philosophers of mind in leading universities is, I think, a massive shift. Now, I've tried to push this argument further. I wrote a paper a couple of years ago in the Journal of Consciousness Studies called Is the Sun Conscious? Everyone in India, most Hindus at least, think it is. It's a god. The Gayatri Mantra, one of their prayers, is addressed to the sun. The Surya Namaskar, yoga exercise, sun prostrations, which I myself have done every day for nearly 50 years, is a very well-known Indian practice. So what I've done in the light of modern science is purely scientific arguments, is the sun conscious? Because if panpsychism is true, then why stop at the human brain? Or why shouldn't the sun be conscious? Why not other stars? Why not the whole galaxy with an even higher level of mind? Why not the whole universe? So you see, they can't avoid that now. I mean, they're on a slippery slope, and I'm just trying to push them down a bit faster. So once we get to panpsychism, then old-style materialism begins to look very threadbare and limited. And I think the other thing is that in the within biology, which is the most hardcore of the mechanistic sciences, the spell cast by molecular biology for such a long time is beginning to wane. There are now proper biologists like Michael Levin at Tufts University in Boston. He's my favorite biologist at the moment, who are doing very holistic biological research based on morphogenetic fields, top-down causation, and so on, not trying to build it all up from molecules and genes and proteins, but with overarching causal principles, which is bringing us back to a more holistic view. And then there's also the climate change has forced us to recognize that we're all interconnected, the whole Earth and its atmosphere are interconnected, which the Gaia hypothesis says. But then there's this sort of interconnection of all life forms and a whole new view of ecology. My son Merlin wrote a book called Entangled Life about fungi, which some of you may have seen, which I think puts that point of view extremely well. I mean, I'm biased, obviously, but I think that it's his view of any kind of ecological interconnectedness of things is becoming part of normal consciousness now. So old-style reductionistic consciousness, the old-style molecular biology type reductionism is no longer as dominant as it was. The Human Genome Project didn't lead to all the promises that it promised coming true. On the contrary, it turned out to be very, very disappointing for those who really believed in that approach. And so I think for these and other reasons, there's a new spirit. There's also a sense of humility in science that I've never seen before that came out as a result of the replication crisis, which round about 2015, it became clear that most papers in top journals in biomedicine, psychology, and various other branches of science could not be replicated. Whereas previous to that, you had people saying, oh, science is the only way to truth, you know, it's true because it's peer-reviewed and it's all replicated. Turns out most scientific studies, no one even tries to replicate them. And when they do, it turns out that many of them don't replicate. And that's, I think, largely as a result of scientists publishing their best results. And you get promoted in science through very perverse incentives by the number of papers you publish in the citation index of the papers, bibliometric measurements, which affect promotion, research assessment exercises, grants, etc. So there's a huge incentive for scientists to publish good results that will go into impressive results that will go into top journals. And I did a research project informally asking people in different branches of science what percentage of their actual data they publish. And in most branches, it's 5 to 10%. If you only had to fill in 5 to 10% of your income and expenses for your income tax return, it would look very different from if you had to fill them all in. And there's now an attempt to deal with this through pre-registration of papers, which parapsychologists have been doing for years. They led the way in all this kind of thing because they were so often accused of not being replicable and not having all these rigorous things. Parapsychologists, much more double-blind and pre-registered than any other branch of science. But the fact so much of it turns out to be non-replicable has led to a kind of humility in top journals of science and among many scientists. That old confidence, we've got it right, we know best, science is totally solid, watertight, and so that has been punctured, and a good thing too, because what this research has revealed is something that science and technology studies have been telling us for a long time, that scientists are human beings with human virtues and human faults, just like everybody else, instead of being superhuman creatures of supreme objectivity. Anyway, all of this, I think, is leading to a change in making science become much more oriented towards holistic studies and a holistic approach.
Yes.
First, yeah, thanks for a really great talk. It was really interesting to hear your path and the different stuff
that you've got up to. So you've been fairly critical of some parts of modern science and a modern scientific approach. And we've seen in the last few years how sentiment against science can be like very influential throughout the pandemic and things like that. So I wondered, with books like The Science Delusion and some of your other works, whether anyone's used anything you've written to justify things you don't agree with at all that you thought can be harmful, or whether that's not been the case for you.
No, it is the case. And sometimes, I don't think it's a very serious problem, but there have been people who tried to ally, get me to endorse anti-vax campaigns and all sorts of weird fringe things. And I guess at least one a week, people who are trying to get me to endorse UFOs or unidentified aerial phenomena. Well, I have a completely open mind about those. It's just not a field I'm very interested in, so I don't have an opinion one way or the other. In terms of the anti-vax campaign, you know, I've replied and said, well, I've had my vaccine and I'm grateful we've got them, you know. So I do what I can to say where it's relevant. The reason the book's called The Science Delusion is because my publishers insisted on calling it The Science Delusion, because they said, because it was playing off Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. I didn't want to call it that because I didn't want to make Dawkins the fulcrum for this, because I derived at all this with nothing to do with Dawkins. But they said it would sell twice as many. So in the end, they prevailed. In America, I had a title, the same book has a different title, much more what I actually intend, which is, it's called Science Set Free in the United States. Here, the subtitle is Freeing the Spirit of Inquiry, which is really what I wanted the title to be. So I'm definitely not anti-science, but I do think that the anti-science movement is fueled by the kind of dogmatic skepticism that is all too common. You know, when people say they've had an experience, their dog knows when they're coming home, or they know who's calling on the phone, a lot of scientists will put them down. They'll just say, oh, it's just a coincidence. You know, you do a course on statistics or something like that. I've seen people put down in the most horrible, bullying way by people who claim the authority of science for what is, in fact, nothing but prejudice. And that's certainly very bad for public relations. And I think the other area that's been very bad for public relations is the dismissal of complementary and alternative medicine. Because the Medical Research Council funds only, as far as I know, only orthodox molecular type work, mechanistic medicine. And it used to have a broader approach, but they've now brought all their different institutes together in the Francis Crick Institute. And Francis Crick was a molecular biologist. I knew him. We were friends. So we got on very well, even though we differed in our views. But he was never a doctor. He never cured anyone in his life. He worked out the molecular structure of DNA. So the whole institute is called the Francis Crick Institute, and the emphasis is on molecular medicine. But there's tons of evidence that all sorts of other methods work, and even if it's only the placebo effect, the placebo effect is interesting in its own right and would be a very important, it's an important topic for scientific research. So the fact that when a lot of people haven't been cured by Western medicine, they then go to various alternative practitioners, an area which on the whole is unregulated, unresearched, outside the pale of scientific understanding, it's, I think, the wrong approach. I think the if we had some part of the medical research budget used to do outcome studies and see what works, we'd do much better. You know, if someone has cold sores, for example, regular medicine doesn't work too well. But if a homeopath says they can cure it, or an acupuncturist, let them try, have a randomized trial and see which works best. And whichever works best, however it works, whether it's more placebo effect or would be the one that would be the most cost effective to be approved by NICE and be on an NHS in an expanded form. So these kinds of knee-jerk prejudices, which come all too easily from the scientific world, not the whole scientific community at all. If you talk about the scientific community, then you have to include Indian scientists and Chinese scientists and South American scientists and African scientists who are larger in number together than Western scientists in Europe and America. And most of them, having worked and lived in India, most of them certainly don't take the narrowly dogmatic mechanistic view. They go along with it at work just because they want to keep their jobs, but they certainly don't believe it. And even here, the number of people who really believe it, as surveys show, is not the majority. Probably about 25% of people working in science, engineering, and maths and computer information science are hardcore materialist believers in the materialist worldview. Then there's another 20% these surveys show who have sort of vaguely open-minded. But about 45% classify themselves as religious, spiritual, or spiritual but not religious, with a much more holistic view, and certainly not. So someone like Richard Dawkins doesn't speak, nor do the guerrilla skeptics on Wikipedia speak for they claim to speak for the scientific community, but actually they don't. They speak for themselves and for a group of very committed materialists for whom scientism has become a kind of religion.
Amazing. Fantastic. Thank you very much.